This is World Briefing with Ray Furlong. We begin the programme, as so often this year, with the events shaking the Arab world. Today they've claimed their fourth Arab leader. After long-serving leaders were toppled in Tunisia, Egypt and then Libya, now the Yemeni president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, has agreed to go. The agreement was signed in Saudi Arabia, and afterwards the head of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, said President Saleh would be heading straight for New York for medical treatment. The United Nations envoy to Yemen, Yamal Ben Omar, said the power transfer would be supervised by the Yemeni vice president.
The agreement reached by Yemeni parties under the auspices of the United Nations extends to the vice president the necessary powers to implement the terms of the Gulf Initiative and the mechanisms of its implementation, and early presidential elections in a period not to exceed 90 days from the moment of the signing of the Gulf Initiative.
In a moment, we'll consider what's next for Yemen. But first, Sebastian Usher looks back at President Saleh's more than three decades in power.
Ali Abdullah Saleh unified North and South Yemen in 1990. But United Yemen, of which he was formally elected president in 1994, has always been threatening to fracture into a failed state. Amongst the challenges he used force of varying ferocity to try to control were Shia rebels, known as Houthis, in the north, Marxist rebels in the south, and the ever-growing threat of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. He presented himself, as many of his fellow veteran Arab leaders also did for decades, as the only bulwark against violent anarchy. At home, he was known as a survivor, unafraid to use tough tactics to stay in power. He was born into a tribe living near the capital, Sana'a, and had only a limited education before joining the army. He rose to prominence as a military governor, becoming leader of what was then North Yemen in 1978. He did little to calm tensions with South Yemen, which increasingly resented the northerners' power and influence. Many people in South Yemen were against unification, and a brief conflict erupted in 1994. But President Saleh prevailed. He managed to stay in power for more than three decades, though his authority was steadily eroding. As with so much of the Arab world, it was the failure to provide the essentials for Yemen's growing population that finally became too much for Yemenis. Living conditions coloured by repression, corruption, high unemployment, and some 40% of people living on less than $2 a day drove the protest movement against him.
Well, for more on this story, I'm joined now in the studio by our Arab Affairs editor, Rami Rahayem. Rami, the president had promised to go on several previous occasions and then pulled out at the last minute. So why has he decided to sign this and go now?
Well, probably the pressure has become too much from neighbouring countries, from the regional and international powers who are very much concerned about the situation in Yemen, and also concerned about the possibility of this situation spilling over into neighbouring strategic countries such as Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries.
So he's been pushed into it?
He has been pushed into it by the neighbouring GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council, as well as probably behind the scenes, but no less significantly the United States, who have been all of whom have been very concerned about the increasing instability in the country.
So is it significant that he's going there for medical treatment? Is that part of the deal, do you think?
Well, probably not. He doesn't have much to do in Yemen. However, there's always the danger of overstating the importance of this. His sons, who hold very sensitive positions in security forces, are still there. And the coming National Unity Government will include his loyalists. So real power has not been transferred. There's only been the President Saleh basically leaving the country, going somewhere else, probably returning to the country, remaining an honorary president until after 90 days have passed since the signing of the agreement. But the reality on the ground has not changed, and it remains to be seen exactly what kind of power-sharing deal will emerge from this before we can really see whether there's real change in Yemen.
Well, very briefly, there are so many different factions in Yemen. They all have to be signed up for this, don't they?
They all have to be signed up. There's a traditional tribal opposition. There's also a number of former army commanders who were very much part of the power structure in Yemen and then broke off. All of this, and on one side, and also the demonstrators who don't subscribe to any of these parts, are a completely different story.
So still a way to go in Yemen?
definitely a way to go.
OK, well, thanks very much, and we'll come back to you a bit later. Let's go now to Bahrain, where it's been officially acknowledged that the country used torture and excessive force on pro-democracy protesters during the uprising there in February and March this year. At least 35 people have been killed and 1,600 arrested during protests which have continued sporadically since the peak of the violence 8 months ago. Earlier, the findings of a highly anticipated independent report were released to the country's king, with the media watching closely. The head of the Independent Commission of Inquiry, Sherif Bassiouni, gave a graphic account of the treatment meted out to protesters. Our correspondent, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, was there.
This report is going to make very uncomfortable reading for Bahrain's King Hamad and his government. It is extremely critical of the way it suppressed pro-democracy protests here in February and March, and even more critical of the government's behaviour in its aftermath. The chief of the Independent Commission of Inquiry, Professor Sherif Bassiouni, found the Bahraini authorities guilty of illegal arrests, forced confessions, unfair trials, and the systematic use of torture. And he went on to outline in detail some of the torture techniques that were used on detainees.
Severe beating, use of water pipes and wooden and metal buttons and other forms of torture and electrocution and threats of rape and humiliation of religious sects.
In his speech in reply, King Hamad welcomed the report. He talked of this being a day that will be remembered in the history of Bahrain. His spokesman, Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Khalifa, said King Hamad is committed to punishing all those responsible.
What we've heard from His Majesty is that no one is going to be above the law and that all those responsible will be held accountable. We have proven so by 20 security officers who have been charged and tried for at least five of the people who have passed away tragically.
But a short distance away in a Shia neighbourhood of Bahrain, they were burning tyres and calling for the king to step down. Dr. Fatima Hajj is one of dozens of doctors tried and sentenced to prison terms for conspiring to overthrow the king, a conviction she calls absurd.
Doctors are still suspended. They are not allowed to treat patients. So if the report is just, you know, ink on paper, then it will not do anything. It will not stop the protesters from asking for their rights and their basic rights and for democracy.
Speaking with Professor Bassiouni after the speeches, he admitted it will very much depend now on what Bahrain's king does with the report. Will he act to punish those responsible for the massive violations of human rights? Will he push for reform and remove hardliners from his government? Or will he use the report as window dressing to appease opinion in America and Europe?
Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting from Bahrain there with the questions raised by this report. We heard earlier from our Arab Affairs editor, Rami Rahayem. Rami, the head of the commission called the investigation a unique and historic event in that for the first time an Arab state had voluntarily investigated unrest within its own borders. The US has said it offers a historic opportunity for reconciliation in the Gulf states. Is that all true?
Well, it's a very unusual scene we saw earlier today. However, there's one thing, there's a lot that's been happening behind the scenes which is not evident. There's some kind of politics within the regime going on between hardliners and reformers. And probably this is a very big show of force for the reformers who want to try to present a facade to the international community, to their allies in Europe and the United States, of reform, of moving forward. At the same time, the opposition is still very skeptical, and they've called all of this a brilliant piece of PR, because what the opposition is saying is all of this depends on the implementation of the recommendations of the report.
Okay, well, that's one we'll have to keep watching then. As is Egypt, where a ceasefire was formally declared a few hours ago in Tahrir Square in Cairo, where there have been clashes since the weekend between Egyptian security forces and protesters who are demanding a faster transition to civilian rule. But soon after that truce was announced, military police were reported to have used tear gas on demonstrators who threw stones in return. Around the area, the continuous sound of ambulances carrying the injured can be heard. Well, earlier I spoke to our correspondent in Cairo, Yolande Nell, who described the scene in the city.
there's quite chaotic scenes, fires burning around the edge of Tahrir Square, and what we've been able to hear and see evidence of is canister after canister of tear gas being fired again into the side streets. It's just off Tahrir Square, close to the Interior Ministry, and this has been the scene of the really most violent confrontations between protesters and the police. Earlier there were soldiers that were also brought in to help guard the Ministry of the Interior, and riot police were moved back, but we've also seen riot police on the streets again, clad in black with their big protective shields.
Is there anything that can break the apparent impasse?
I think it's difficult to say. There's certainly political forces at work trying to resolve this situation. There is a hard core of protesters who are really getting more and more angry with the police forces because of the brutality that we've seen in the past few days. There are definite political divisions. The Muslim Brotherhood, other Islamist groups, if you step away from the square, just go a short distance away, they're continuing with their political campaigning now that we've heard that the plans for parliamentary elections to begin on Monday are going to continue as scheduled. And other Islamist groups, Salafis that I was talking to overnight, now seem to have left the square. Many liberals are sticking by their request, their demand, that there should be an immediate transfer to what they're calling a national salvation government, a civilian government by the military council that rules Egypt at the moment. But other groups, obviously with the parliamentary elections coming, feel they have a lot to lose, feel it was a big concession to have the announcement of presidential elections, something we hadn't heard before, that they would be taking place by the middle of next year. And they feel that this this timetable is adequate.
Yolande Nell speaking to me a couple of hours ago from Cairo. Well, once more, our Arab Affairs editor, Rami Rahayem. Rami, we've heard about another day of big developments in Egypt, Bahrain and Yemen. So where does this leave the Arab Spring? Is the momentum still there to bring changes to these and other countries?
The momentum is very much still there, and the inspirational factor is also still there. However, the element that's come into play, which is less talked about, is the geopolitical element. The fact that other than this inspirational mood of people power taking over the Middle East, this could be a bit of a simplistic view of what's going on, especially if you look at places like Syria, Yemen and Bahrain, where there's a very complicated geopolitical struggle between different states that are looking at the development on the streets at first as a threat to certain interests, but then also as an opportunity. So we have to look at all of that at the same time as we analyze the reasons why so many youth in the Arab world are going out on the street risking their lives for change.
And when you talk about that geopolitical struggle, the key players in that, Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Well, Saudi Arabia and the rest of the GCC, definitely huge players. Iran, but also Turkey, and most definitely the West behind a lot. The United States and Western Europe also have their interests in the region. They also see threats and opportunities emerging in different Arab states. The problem that makes the vision a little bit obscure is that all of these leaders always present a facade of morality and human rights when they speak about these issues. But there's always interests at play that are much deeper than that. And that includes the West. So a lot more is going on than just protests, although protests are the new factor that has stunned the world this year.
Indeed it has. Thanks very much indeed. Rami Rahayem, Arab Affairs editor. You're listening to World Briefing with me, Ray Furlong, on the BBC World Service. Let's look at some other stories now. With no sign of an end to the financial crisis in the Eurozone, the European Commission has proposed measures which would give it much more authority over the budgets of Eurozone countries. It has also put forward the idea of issuing so-called stability bonds as a way of bolstering the sovereign debt market. Germany, however, has expressed opposition to the proposal. Here's our Europe correspondent, Chris Morris.
The European Commission is proposing intrusive laws which would give it wide powers over the budgets of Eurozone countries. Governments could be asked to send their budget plans to Brussels before they're given to national parliaments. There'd also be much closer surveillance of countries which run into trouble. Without such changes, said the President of the Commission, José Manuel Barroso, it would be difficult, if not impossible, to sustain a common currency. Mr. Barroso also released a report which argued that commonly issued euro bonds, which he called stability bonds, could be the best way to create a more stable sovereign debt market in the eurozone.
Stability bonds will not solve our immediate problems and cannot replace the reforms that are needed in countries currently under pressure. But it is also important to show to public opinion, to international investors, that we are serious about stronger governance in the euro area. And stability bonds are exactly an example of that.
The trouble with euro bonds is that while countries like Italy or Spain would pay less on their debt than they do now, countries like Germany or the Netherlands would pay more. So the proposals for much tougher eurozone rules are part of an effort to change opinions towards euro bonds in Berlin. So far it hasn't worked. Chancellor Merkel certainly isn't impressed.
I think it's inappropriate that the Commission has proposed Eurobonds as a solution and has done so now. Just by even proposing the idea, they give the impression that by sharing debt, we'll solve the problems we have with the structure of the European Monetary Union. And that's simply not the case.
So, no definitive solution, but some EU officials still believe German opposition could soften if the only alternatives are even more costly.
Chris Morris reporting. And meanwhile, a German government debt auction has proved to be a flop, indicating that it's not immune to the eurozone crisis. Europe's strongest economy failed to find buyers for 35% of the 10-year bonds on offer. To get more on this, I've been speaking to our correspondent, Andrew Walker.
First of all, I suppose one should acknowledge that sometimes these partial failures, if you like, of government bond sales do occur. But this one is regarded by a lot of people in the financial markets as being particularly unwelcome. It's partly, I think, that a general spread of the anxiety about the whole euro area, spreading from first the smaller peripheral countries to some of the larger ones like Italy, even France. And now it does look like some investors are more reluctant than they were to hold even German government debt. In addition, there is the proposal that's been put by the Commission, the European Commission, for eurozone-wide government bonds shared between all the member countries, if you like. That could conceivably end up with Germany having to take on the liabilities of some other countries, and that would make its own debt less attractive to hold.
One financial analyst here in London has described this sale as a disaster.
It's strong language, isn't it? I have to say that Germany will be able to raise the additional money that it needs over the next few days. The unsold bonds are held by the Bundesbank, which I'm sure will be able to sell them in due course. But it is certainly a very, very unwelcome development. Germany was very much seen as the bedrock, the absolute guarantor of any hopes of financial stability returning to the eurozone. So the fact that it's had difficulty selling all these bonds is a very negative development.
And you mentioned euro bonds. José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission, has come out with this idea today. He calls them stability bonds. Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, has poured cold water over it very publicly. This isn't the message of unified and decisive leadership in the eurozone that the markets really want, is it?
That's right, and there are other areas where there's been a problem of political leadership and unity. For example, in the role of the European Central Bank in dealing with the debt crisis, should it be going into the markets much more aggressively to bring down the interest rates that governments are having to pay?
That was our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker, speaking to me a bit earlier on. Now, the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan has publicly apologised for the mass killing of Kurds by government forces 74 years ago. It's the first time any Turkish leader has made such a gesture. His government has attempted to win over the large Kurdish minority by improving their legal and cultural rights. But he has also approved a tough stance against supporters of the Kurdish rebel movement in his country. From Istanbul, here's our correspondent Jonathan Head.
There are many dark chapters in Turkey's history which have remained closed to its citizens. Now the Prime Minister has opened one of them by offering an apology on behalf of the Turkish state for the killing of at least 13,000 ethnic Kurds in the late 1930s.
If it is necessary to apologize on behalf of the state, and if there is such a discourse, I will apologize. And I am apologizing.
It took place when the Kurdish population of Dersim, a central Anatolian province, resisted the efforts of the new Turkish Republic to exert its authority there. A full-scale military operation was launched to pacify Dersim using aerial bombardment and poisonous gas. The incident laid some of the foundations for today's Kurdish insurgency against the state. It's a sensitive issue for Turkish nationalists because modern Turkey's revered founding father, Kemal Atatürk, was president at the time, and his own adopted daughter, Turkey's first female pilot, took part in the bombing. However, Mr. Erdogan's apology is viewed with suspicion by some Kurds, who see it as an opportunistic move against the main opposition party, the secular CHP. The CHP was in office at the time of the Dersim operation and has been shaken this month by an internal debate sparked by one of its own deputies, who's from the area and called on the party to acknowledge its responsibility for the killings.
Jonathan Head in Istanbul. An American auction house is selling a checklist from the Apollo 13 space mission in 1970, which nearly ended in disaster. After an explosion on board, the commander of the spacecraft, Jim Lovell, rewrote the checklist to guide his crew back to Earth. Apollo 13 did not complete the mission to the moon, and its journey home grabbed the world's attention. And as Jane Peel reports, its astronauts would not have survived without the recalculations that Commander Lovell made.
They are just a few words, but along with Neil Armstrong's One Small Step for Man, they're some of the most famous in the history of space travel.
OK, Houston, we've had a problem here.
This is Houston. Say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
Houston, we've had a problem was the mother of all understatements, later recreated and misquoted to dramatic effect in the Hollywood film Apollo 13. An explosion on board the spacecraft 2 days into NASA's third mission to the moon left the three astronauts in grave danger.
The flight of the Apollo 13 to the moon is in serious jeopardy this morning and is not going to make a moon landing.
Commander Jim Lovell had just 15 minutes to make a series of critical mathematical calculations and transfer data from one computer to another before a loss of power threatened to strand them in space. It is Commander Lovell's checklist, with his handwritten calculations, that's being auctioned in Dallas next week. The chief engineer at the UK Space Agency, Professor Richard Crowther, explained the significance of the document.
Effectively, it defines where the spacecraft is in orbit and its orientation. So if they got that wrong, then if they fired the thrusters, then they would potentially go in the wrong direction and therefore not be captured by the Earth's atmosphere.
So they wouldn't have been able to get back safely at all?
Absolutely not. So it's very important to transfer that information accurately, but also to make sure that it's legible.
An extremely loud applause here in Mission Control.
On April the 17th, 1970, Apollo 13 splashed down safely. Commander Lovell, who's now 83, says the calculations that saved lives were all down to simple arithmetic.
Jane Peel on the importance of doing your maths homework. You've been listening to World Briefing with Ray Furlong, and it's just coming up to 1929 GMT.